This is the Bates Bobcast, our weekly podcast where we take a look at the week that was in Bates athletics. My name is Aaron Morse, and for the summer months on the Bobcast, we are taking a trip down memory lane with student athletes from the past. This week, we chat with perhaps the greatest pitcher in Bates baseball history, former New York Yankee farmhand and Maine Baseball Hall of Famer Tom Freeman from the class of 1963. That's coming up on the Bates Bobcast. You can find Tom Freeman all over the Bates baseball record book. He pitched 18 complete games in three seasons and struck out 181 batters. Both are program records to this day. In 1962, Freeman was the winning pitcher in seven of the Bobcats' 12 victories, leading Bates to the Maine State Series title and the Eastern NCAA Finals. And in 1963, he was named a second-team All-American in the College Division by the American Association of College Baseball Coaches. Standing at 6'6", or 6'7", depending on who you ask, Freeman also starred on the basketball court, helping Bates advance to the NCAA Regional Finals in 1961. Freeman graduated with a degree in psychology and a career earned run average of 2.47. He then signed with the New York Yankees and played four seasons in their farm system. As a Yankee minor leaguer, Freeman learned from the great Whitey Ford, and his height was even the subject of a Yogi Berra quote. The Hall of Fame catcher turned Yankee manager was quoted in the Sporting News as saying, "These are the tallest kids I've ever seen in our camps. Good thing we don't pay rookies by the inch." Freeman went on to have a long career at IBM, and in 2016, he was inducted into the Maine Baseball Hall of Fame. Today, he joins the Bobcast to reflect on his time at Bates, including his close relationship with the famed Bates head coach, William Chick Leahy.
I applied to four different colleges, and two were in the Boston area, where I grew up, and I felt like I wanted to get away from home. Bowdoin did not accept me, which made it all the more fun to beat them on the playing fields. But Bates thankfully did accept me, and actually a friend of my mom's was a cousin of Milt Lindholm, which didn't hurt. And my next door neighbor had gone to Bates and graduated in 1955 and had good things to say. So, and actually another friend of my mother's husband was a professor at Bates for quite a while. Anyway, that's how it happened, and rest is history.
Certainly, and then you played basketball and baseball there at Bates. We'll start with your, actually, before we get to Chick Leahy, who I know had a big impact. I know you played with under Bob Peck for basketball and had a lot of success there also. What was Coach Peck like?
Bob was very military-like. He was an ex-Marine, but he was a good coach, and he went on sabbatical my senior year, and we got another coach that came back to Bates who had been a football coach mainly, named Vern Ullum, and he took the job for that 1 year that Bob was on sabbatical. Well, Vern's method of coaching basketball was, I guess you could describe it as somewhere between football and rugby on a hard court. So it was different, but he was very enthusiastic, and we had a good time.
What do you remember much about your sophomore year, basketball-wise? Because I know the team that season went to the NCAA Regional Finals. It was the kind of the first postseason appearance ever in Bates basketball history there in 1961.
Well, we had a real good team, and basically we had a center named Jim Sutherland who was probably the best rebounder in New England and scored well for us. And I started my sophomore year, and we got nominated for the tournament. And interesting little war story is that our first game was against Springfield, and we had played Springfield during the regular season and beat them. And so prior to the tournament, the coach for Springfield was quoted in the newspaper as saying the reason they lost to us during the season was due to poor scouting. So, needless to say, college by about, I think, 6 or 7 points. So they had a very good team. And maybe you already know this, but when Williams went to the next level to play the Final Eight, it was in Evansville, Indiana. And the shenanigans and the crowds and so forth were so awful that they came back and they convinced what became NESCAC teams not to participate in the NCAA tournaments. That did, I don't think that changed until my son was at Williams and they went to two tournaments. That was in the early 90s. So for all those years, NESCAC teams did not participate in NCAA tournaments. And of course, when we were there, of course, there was no CBB, there was no NESCAC. It was the main state series. It was four teams, the three little schools and the University of Maine and Orono. So that was it. As far as basketball, I learned a lesson my freshman year to pay attention to my books because I was declared ineligible my second semester. So I couldn't play basketball or baseball my freshman year, second semester. So that's the reason I only played 3 years of baseball at Bates. But it was a lesson well learned, and I came back and succeeded in graduating.
I did talk to one of your contemporaries a while back, Howie Vandersee, and he mentioned that, you know, I mean, obviously Bates has always been very, you know, academically oriented, but in particular, in that time, I mean, yeah, sports were an afterthought, I mean, in terms of the campus and whatnot. What was it like, you know, how did you make those adjustments in the classroom when you kind of got that wake-up call, I guess, right?
Like a lot of students, I think, I learned everything in class, and I really didn't know how to study back in the room. So I had to learn how to do that, and that was the basic issue. And in fact, when I finally had grades good enough to have cuts, I don't know today whether everybody has cuts or what, but back then you had to have a certain grade average to have any kind of cuts, to cut class. Well, by the time I got to that level, I was so afraid to take cuts that I never took any anyway. I was afraid I'd miss out on something that I needed to know. And but school was a lot different then. I mean, maybe you've already heard all these things, but we had to go to chapel every week. There were Saturday morning classes because you met three times a week. So that required Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday classes to meet on Saturday morning. We had five courses, not four. So things, maybe it's a retrospect, but things were a little more disciplined and strict and tougher, I thought, anyway. The dining room was more like the Army barracks I went through in basic training.
Mm-hmm.
Today it's like a gourmet restaurant. That's all you can eat. We went through the line, what you got was what you got, and that was it. There was no coming back for more. So those things have changed drastically, of course, for the better.
To the baseball side of things, Chick Leahy, obviously, I mean, I've read quotes from you talking about how what a, you know, great coach he was, an inspirational coach, and I've talked to his wife, Ruth, a few times as about Chick, but what are some Chick Leahy stories that really kind of embody what kind of man he was?
You know, he was just a tremendous person, not only because he was a coach that, an excellent coach, and but just his personality and his way of teaching and coaching, and you know, the respect he had for the opponent. He wanted to win more than anyone, but it was in a respectful way. And we had some great rivalries, especially with Colby and their coach John Winken, who was a very well-known coach. And we remained lifelong friends, and never went to Lewiston without stopping by to see him and Ruth, and we knew all the kids, and so we have great memories. And I think one of the best stories I have regarding on the field, an on the field event, was during a game at Bates. We had a play at the plate. The opposing runner was called safe, and I can't even remember the issue that that was being argued, but Chick came off the bench, and he really got into it with the home plate umpire, whose name was Bill Donovan, a well-known local guy who had umpired for years. And they kept going at it, and I walked off the mounds towards halfway to the plate, and just, I could hear what was going on. And eventually, Bill lost it, and he started yelling at Chick. He said, "Chick, you don't know anything about baseball. You don't know the rules." So Chick, that was the wrong thing to say to Chick. So Chick gets in his face and says, "Bill," he says, "I've forgotten more about baseball than you'll ever know." And walked back to the bench. I thought that was a great retort, and I had to hide my laugh because it didn't change the decision any. Another little story was that after my first year professionally, it was a half season, I came back in the fall to Bates and went in to see Chick in his office just to say hello and talk about my experience that past summer. And we must have talked for half an hour. And I was about to get, I was just getting up to leave. And Chick said, "Oh, Tom, wait a minute. So he opened the drawer to his desk and he took out the certificate. And he says, "Oh, I've had this all summer long." He says, "It's your All-American certificate." You know, when you're named an All-American, you get this big certificate. And so he gave it to me. I thought that was really funny because that's the first time I ever found out that I had been named an All-American. No one ever wrote me a letter, and no one ever said anything. So I walked out of his office on cloud nine and laughed down the walkway. And the interesting thing was that John Winken, the coach for Colby, was on the committee, the selection committee, and he signed the certificate. He's one of the three signatures on the certificate. So anyway, and Chick said later, he said, "You know, John was he spoke up for you and was one of the people who were really responsible for you being nominated." So I thought that was nice because he was such an enemy of ours.
Right.
But it was just a great relationship. And it was, I can say that was, I don't know of any player that played for him that didn't feel the same way. And so that's that.
Your junior year in baseball, you got to compete in the, you know, NCAAs there, Fairleigh Dickinson. I understand there was some words exchanged with Fairleigh Dickinson. Tell us about that kind of background, because I read about what they were calling you guys and everything.
We went down by bus, and of course, and we stayed in one of the dormitories, and the first game was against Fairleigh Dickinson. It was a pretty big school. I think there were like 10,000 students there. So I don't know how they got classified as a college division, but which, by the way, when we played, there were only two divisions. They didn't have 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
It was college division and university division. So anyway, so we get out on the field to do our warm-ups and so forth, and the bench for Fairleigh Dickinson was really ragging on us, you know. And they said things like, you know, you guys are hicks from Maine, and you know, we play St. John's and we play Villanova and we play this, that, and the other. You know, you can't compete with us, and you know, all this kind of crap. So we didn't say anything. We just played ball. And of course, the ironic part of it is, I think out of those starting nine that we had, seven of us were from Massachusetts. So, and I don't think anyone was from Maine. There was a guy from Connecticut, and I don't know where the other guy was from. So if they had looked at the program, they might have known that we weren't from Maine, even though we represented a Maine school. But so it was very satisfying to beat them 2-1. And the field wasn't very good for a big school like that. And the outfield fence ran almost straight across the outfield instead of having an arc to it. as a result, center field was only about 310 feet. And the score, we won 2-1, and the only scoring was done on home runs. So they hit a solo home run off me, I think in the third or fourth inning. And then Ron Taylor, our left fielder, hit a two-run homer off them. And that's the way the game ended. And but, you know, if they had a normal field, who knows how long the game would have run. So that's the way it goes.
At the time, did you realize how significant it was for, you know, Bates, not only baseball but also basketball, to have, you know, made NCAAs like that? Or was the history kind of not something you were aware of at the time or anything like that?
I don't think anyone before me, or I don't know if anyone after me, has played basketball and baseball and gone to the NCAAs in both sports. But my son, my youngest son, was the captain of the Williams basketball team, graduated in 95, and they used to play Bates. And I came up to see him play in Lewiston his junior year. And saw some old fans that used to come to see me play. And fortunately, I think he scored 20 points, so he had a good night. But anyway, yeah, it was satisfying to go to those three tournaments. And in both cases, we didn't have any idea we were going to be picked. You know, it just came as a total surprise. I mean, there was no big nominating night or anything. It was... Decisions were made in probably small little offices somewhere.
Yeah.
The funny story about the Springfield tournament, the basketball, was that we had a big contingent of fans go down to the game. One of the fans was lived in my dorm. He was a good friend, still is. He had a bobcat that was mounted on a wooden plaque, like standing up on a wooden base. It was an actual stuffed bobcat. And he used to take that to all the games and sit in the stands and hold it up and so forth. Well, when the Springfield fans saw that, it got pretty testy, and there was some fisticuffs in the stands. They was trying to steal the bobcat away from us. And we had a bunch of football players that were guarding it, so they didn't get it away. But, and of course, we were playing the game. We didn't know what was going on until afterwards. But those were some funny events. That and the about pranks. One of my classmates used to lead on at least two occasions during the 4 years he was at Bates. He and a buddy of his would go down to Bowdoin, and they'd paint the polar bear in front of the gym. You know, they had a big, huge cement polar bear that they'd go down there and paint it some color. I don't know, maroon or and. His father would have to fork over the money to have it sandblasted and then cleaned up. There were always a few pranks. Like, you probably heard about the fact that they put a Volkswagen inside the lobby of Quorum Library one night.
How do you pull that off?
Yeah, well, it wasn't just turning it on its side to get it in the door, but to do it without getting caught by the night watchman. And they must have had a key to get in. The other prank that I remember particularly was during chapel one morning. Somebody had gotten into the chapel the night before, and they rigged up this wire that ran the whole length of the middle aisle down to the front of the church, of the chapel. And at a designated time, a little electric motor carried a lady's underwear on that wire all the way down the middle aisle. Seemed funny at the time.
In chapel, that probably didn't go over very well with the folks running chapel.
I don't think they caught the person.
I was curious about your teammates. Yeah, I know you play with Howie Vandersee in baseball. What was he like to play with? I mean, obviously, he's known a lot for his football accomplishments, but obviously also played baseball there with you.
Well, Howie was tremendous. He was just as intense on the baseball field as he was on the football field, and when he got a hold of one, you know, it went out forever. And you don't remember, you wouldn't know what the old baseball field used to look like, but anyway, he cleared the fence. It had to be over 400 feet one day. And he was a first baseman, very athletic, a big guy, but very athletic and very positive, always encouraging everyone. And we had my roommate, Monty Wilson, was our center fielder. And my other roommate was Webb Harrison, the lately departed football coach. So the three of us roomed together for 3 years, and it was a good match. We never had a harsh word between us in 3 years, which is pretty unusual. And, you know, we had Eddie Wilson was a second baseman who was has been a trustee and a longtime supporter of Bates College. And John Lawler was a native kid from Auburn, Maine, who played with me both baseball and basketball. And I went to work for him after I retired from IBM. He was a vice president at AT Cross Company in Rhode Island. So I worked for him for several years, and we've been friends for over 60 years. And he lives just over the line in Rhode Island, so we get together all the time. As I said, we had 2 good years, 62 and 63.
So I was wondering about your professional career in baseball, pitching in the Yankees organization. Chick had played in the Yankees organization also. Did you go to him for any advice or anything when you signed with the Yankees? Because he played in their organization as well back in the day.
Oh, Chick played after he got out of the service.
Yeah.
After World War II. So it was the late 40s when he was playing. And but he knew the scouts, and I think he was instrumental in making sure that the Yankee scout got up to see a couple of games. And, you know, there were about 8 teams that were looking at me, and 3 or 4 of them made serious offers for money. And but I was most disappointed in the Red Sox, because the scout that had been pretty hot on my trail during my junior year, he died that winter, and they kind of dropped the ball. Whoever took over either didn't want to drive to Maine or wasn't excited enough about what he read, so. That was kind of disappointing, because I would have loved to sign with the Red Sox. But the Yankees were a first-class organization, and when I saw the way some other organizations treated the minor league systems, I was glad that I made the choice I did. So, yeah, basically, just glad I gave it a try, because if I hadn't, I would have always wondered whether I would have gone all the way. But when I left, it was time. And to get a real job. And I have to give a lot of credit to my wife, Claire, who put up with, I think we counted one time, that between the day I graduated from Bates and the day I hired with IBM, we lived in 13 different places. And we were like vagabonds. And then we had our first child the last year I played, and it was time to move on. It didn't look like I was going to make it to Yankee Stadium, so that's what happened. And actually, my wife's father was a night watchman at Bates, like an Omi, we used to call him, but he was more than that. He was a great guy. And he went to work, actually, after I met Claire. And he was well known on campus. All the students loved him, and they used to call him Mr. B. And if you talk to any alumni who graduated in the 60s and 70s, they'll know who Mr. B is. And you know, we kind of have a Bates history, and my wife growing up in Lewiston. So that's my little story about that.
I was wondering how the minor league baseball experience compared to the college baseball experience for you, just kind of, you know, everyday life and whatnot.
Well, on the field, it's another level. It's, I mean, everyone that signed had to have, or perceived to have ability to justify, you know, being signed and maybe given some money. And so the level of competition was certainly better in college, although I suppose nowadays in Division I baseball, you probably got some teams that could compete in the minor leagues. at maybe at the lower levels. But, you know, all the pitchers threw hard, and the batters had good swings, and but only a few players make it. And I did have the pleasure of playing with a few guys that did make it in the Yankee system, and against a few players that made it for other teams. And that was kind of interesting. I played with Bobby Mercer and Fritz Peterson and Mel Stottlemyre. And I played against Rod Carew and a couple of other guys I can't remember right now, but who made it to the Hall of Fame. So it does happen. But it's I said it was a vagabond's life. 1 year after we got married, my wife met me at the team that I was assigned to after spring training, which happened to be Greensboro, North Carolina, in the Carolina League. And so I picked her up at the airport and dropped her off at an apartment I had rented and filled with food, and and I left for the ballpark. And I said, I'll see you maybe around 9 or 10. So I came back around 9 or 10 and said, honey, don't unpack. I've just been sent to Binghamton, New York. So the next morning, we packed up the car and drove to Binghamton, New York. And fortunately, the landlady bought all our food, which was very nice of her. And those are the kind of stories you remember. Another funny story is one night in Binghamton, we always came out to start warming up around 4:30, 5 o'clock for a 7 o'clock game. And usually there was only like 400 or 500 people in the stands. And this night, as time went on, the stands started filling up and filling up and filling up until they were full. There was an empty seat. There must have been 1,500 people there. So I went along, someone in the box row seats who came to every game, and we all knew him. And I said, he said, what's going on tonight? You know, the place is full. And he said, oh, this is IBM night. Oh, well, at that point, I didn't know IBM from ABC. So I didn't know that I'd be working for them a couple of years later. But one night a year, they would buy out the park and give the seats to their employees. Their headquarters was in the Tri-City area there. And that was the biggest crowd we ever had all season long.
You pitched against Rod Carew. What was that like?
You could tell he was destined to make it because he was just such a good hitter, his form and what he tried to do. You know, going back to Bates itself, you know, we had some memorable professors, and to say nothing of Milt Lindholm, who was a legend. But we had people like Dr. Tagule Bowie, an English professor, and Professor Bushman, who taught German. And he was a tremendous basketball fan. And his son had played there, as well as the debate coach. He was a big basketball fan too, and they'd sit up in the balcony, and with Dean Boyce, who was the dean of men, and they were the most rabid fans. I mean, they were almost, if they were down in the stands, they'd have been thrown out. But another story for you is that during my senior year, or during the spring, most students were taking interviews with companies or schools or whatever. So one day, about 2 weeks before graduation, I get a call from Dr. Kendall, who was a professor of psychology and education, and he kind of ran the process of interviews, scheduling companies and so forth. So he said, he left a note in my mailbox, and he said, could you please come and see me? And he gave me a time. And so I went into his office and come in and sit down, and he said, how's it going? A little small talk. And then he said, you know, I've noticed that you haven't taken any interviews with any companies or schools. I said, do you have a do you have a plan? What are you thinking about doing after graduation? And I said, yeah, I realize I haven't taken any interviews with companies that you schedule, but I've taken several interviews with companies involved in professional baseball, and my intention is to sign a contract and play ball. Well, he almost fell off his chair. He couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that somebody from baseball wasn't going to, you know, take a traditional route after graduation. So we didn't have much to say to each other after that. So I just said thank you for your time. I said appreciate it, but I've got my own agenda here. And you know, between my first half year, of course, the Vietnam War was going on, just starting. So when I got home in September, I said to my parents, I said, you know, I've got to do something about my military obligation if I expect to keep playing ball, because if I get drafted, forget it. So I joined the reserves, was off to basic training within 2 weeks, and spent the next winter vacation at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, to do my basic training. And got out just in time to go to spring training in Florida. And so I had 6 years in the reserves. So the year I was in Binghamton, my mother kept calling me on the phone and saying, you know, I'm getting these letters from the Army saying you're not attending drills. And if you don't show up, we're going to reinstate you onto active duty, and you have to do 3 years. So my mother's frantic, of course. And so I said, why don't you contact, and I gave her the name of a man who had scouted me and was from Arlington originally and had been very helpful to us. So she got a hold of him. He got a hold of the New York front office in New York and told him what was going on. And they said, oh, gee, we overlooked sending a letter to the Army for your deferment, you know, your occupational deferment during the summer, which alleviated you having to do drills. So because they had forgotten to do it, you know, the Army didn't know any different. So they got to the Army in time, and I could just see myself being dragged off the mound some night by the military police. But again, that's my war story for Army service. Fortunately, I never got activated to go to Vietnam, and which I'm thankful for. The other thing I mentioned, I didn't mention, but when we're talking about dining in those days, there was no co-ed dining. It was men's commons, and the ladies had the dining room in the dorm over there. Except on Sunday at noontime, you could go over to the women's dining hall and have co-ed dining. They didn't want you getting too close.
Is that how you met your wife then?
No, I met her at a party locally. And
okay.
And actually, it was a funny story. I thank my teammate, Monty Wilson, because we had just come back from a road trip to Boston for two baseball games in the spring. And I was sitting in my dorm room, and Monty came in, and he had been out to this party. It was on one of the lakes, Trip Lake, I think it was. And so he said, hey, you're not doing anything. Why don't you come out to this party? We're having fun and so forth and so on. And I said, geez, you know, I'm really tired. I don't feel like it. So eventually he talked me into it. And that's where I met Claire. And a couple of weeks later, we had a date. And the rest is history, as they say. That was like 57, 58 years ago. And that's how we met.
Awesome. Going back to your pitching a little bit, I was curious about, from a pitching perspective, because I haven't read anywhere, what were your, like, pitches? What did you throw out there on the mound? What made you, in your opinion, an effective pitcher there at Bates?
In terms of delivery, I was what is referred to as a sinker slider pitcher, fastball which sank, and slider. I didn't have a big breaking overhand curveball because my delivery was three quarters to sidearm.
Oh.
So you can't get that kind of a break when you're throwing from the side. So my slider and my fastball were the main two pitches. Change up once in a while. But at that level, you know, just keep throwing hard.
Yeah.
If you throw a change up, they might hit it. And that's pretty much what I had my whole career. In my last 2 years, I was mainly a relief pitcher, and I was always more effective against right-handed batters, and because of the sidearm delivery.
In pro ball, you were a relief pitcher, right? Because at Bates, you...
Right.
Yeah, right. Okay.
No. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Almost every time, every game was a complete game.
Yeah.
And, I think I still hold 4 or 5 records, and we only had like 12 to 14 games a year.
Right.
But I'm not sure if anyone will... The way they play these days, they just don't do complete games. Even if the pitcher were capable, you know, they're so worried about hurting their arms that they only let them throw so many pitches. I don't think Chick ever counted pitches.
Right.
He bases his decision on how well you were doing and, you know, if you told him you were tired, but I never did. I never really got tired, but I'm sure I did. I just wouldn't admit it.
There was one game where you never even broke a sweat, right? Because it was so cold. Is that?
Oh, you read that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was at Tufts.
Yeah.
It seemed like we opened up every year at Tufts because they probably wouldn't come up to Maine for a first game. But yeah, I think I pitched 9 innings and we went in to shower and there wasn't even a circle of sweat under my arm. And it started snowing at the beginning of the game and then eventually stopped. But baseball at that time of year was miserable. I have to tell you, it was brutal. And as I said in my Hall of Fame remarks, you know, our southern trip was to Boston.
Yeah.
And all our state series games were north of us. And, you know, we never got out on the field hardly to practice. Everything was in the cage. Well, I'll leave it at that.
Cold weather and not ideal for baseball. I mean, it sounds like, though, that, like, I mean, it was really all about, you know, your teammates and Chick in terms of what made it a good experience, right?
Yeah. Oh, the team, the camaraderie of the teammates that you played with. And, you know, it was having John Waller play both basketball and baseball with me.
Mm.
It was fun. And actually, Howie played 1 year of basketball.
Okay.
I think 1 year. But, you know, that's tough. 3 sports. It's tough enough playing two. You know, we no sooner got through the basketball season than we were in the cage the next day. You seem to know about Bob Peck, but he became the AD at Williams College.
Right.
He was there for many, many years. And when I took my youngest boy up to interview at Williams, the coach there, a few days later, he ran into Peck. And he said, hey, he said, I'm considering a player coming here who says that his father played for you at Bates. And so Peck says, well, who was that? And he said, his name's Matt Freeman. His dad's name is Tom. And he said, oh, no, no, that can't be. That's impossible. He says, he's not old enough. He's not old enough to have a son coming to Williams. So he'd lost track of time.
So did you reconnect with him a bit when your son went to Williams then?
Oh, yeah. When we'd go, I went up to most of the games up at Williamstown, the home games, and a lot of the away games. But, oh, yeah, he was very cordial. In fact, during graduation, his first wife had died a few years before, and he had remarried. And so they were in the process of selling his house and moving into hers. So he said, Tom, he says, why don't you and your family come and stay in my house? I'm not living in it right now. And it was wonderful. It was a big house. And so we all stayed there. And so he was always very nice to me. And he was very helpful to a lot of coaches, especially in football, like Webb and Russ Riley in basketball. And he gave them assistant coaching positions at BU. And when he was there, Peck had gone to BU to be the AD there before he went out to Williamstown. And so he was very instrumental in helping several coaches that came out of Bates. So Chick Leahy never had an assistant coach when we were there. It was just, they didn't have a budget for those kinds of things. And the other subject about recruiting, everybody says, well, were you recruited? I said, what? No, there was no such thing as recruiting at Bates during those years. I mean, although I think Howie told me once that Bob Hatch used to go out on trips and interview kids and give a talk about Bates, which I guess could be called recruiting. But no one ever contacted me once about baseball or basketball during that period. I wasn't a superstar in either one in high school. I mean, I did well, but not enough to create people recruiting me.
How did you feel kind of Bates prepared you for the rest of your, you know, career going through life, basically, after graduation? How do you feel Bates kind of prepared you for that?
Well, I guess in a couple of respects, what I learned in terms of turning my academic performance around taught me the value of hard work and sticking to the goals that you have, whether it's in your family life or whether it's in your business life. I felt that as the years go by, there's always a discussion about the value of a liberal arts education. And I believe in it tremendously because it gives you a well-rounded base of knowledge to communicate with other people in almost any topic, you know. Especially, I was a salesman for my whole career with IBM. So I was always involved with meeting people and having, to socialize and talk about who knows what in addition to the business end of the visit. But so I think it prepared me because I had a broader knowledge of a wide range of topics. So, we had a basic curriculum we had to take, the core courses. And, you had to take religion, philosophy, English, psychology. What else? Cultural heritage for four semesters. Other schools would probably call it humanities, but it was four semesters, your junior and senior year, and it was Western civilization from the Greeks up to Freud. It was like a fire hose of information about everything in history, and that exposed everyone to a tremendous knowledge, and I think that's the reason that the College Bowl team, I don't know if you remember or know that Bates holds the record for number of wins in the College Bowl, which was a program back in the 70s. It was a quiz show for students, and each school had four students on the panel, and they would ask questions sort of like Jeopardy. And Bates was undefeated. The most you could win was five, and then they retired you. And the first year they were on, it was in the late spring, and they won two in a row, and then the show went off the air for the summer. So when they brought them back in the fall, they started counting over again, and they won five in a row, and they retired them. It was really something to watch. Little old Bates College with these guys that could answer anything. So I guess that would be my answer. That it just gave you such a broad education, and whereas if you'd gone to university and knew you were going to major in engineering or some other science, and that's all you took, you would never be exposed to these kinds of things.
Next time on the Bates Bobcast, we'll interview another Bobcat from days gone by who made a huge impact at Bates. Find out who next time on the Bates Bobcast. Bates, Bates, my